As I described to you the explosive church growth that took place in the Calvary Chapel movement, I speak as a spectator. There is no credit to be given to any man. It belongs to God alone. If you understand this perspective, then when I described to you the difficult years, my desert years, you'll know why that I stand in awe at what God has done. And you will celebrate with me the awesome symmetry of God's design. When we see it, we are stunned and amazed. Those pictures of our massive Calvary Chapel baptisms in the Pacific Ocean, in magazines such as Look and Life and Time, Newsweek, they portrayed a human harvest field. Literally, thousands of people can be seen crowding the shores, waiting to be baptized. Images like these illustrate that this is a colossal phenomenon as far as churches go. Professors such as Peter Wagner at Fuller Seminary and Ron Enroth at Westmont College state in their books that there may never have been anything like it in American history. It has been estimated that in a two-year period in the mid-70s, Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa performed over 8,000 baptisms. And during that same period, we were instrumental in over 20,000 conversions to the Christian faith. Our growth rate for that decade was calculated by church growth experts to be near the 10,000% level. Perhaps more staggering still is that the first Sunday morning service at Calvary Chapel Church in Costa Mesa in 1965, there were just 25 people. Now put this in perspective. Not only has that church of 25 members established more than 500 affiliate Calvary Chapels across the world, but that one fellowship in Costa Mesa has grown until the number of people who consider it their home church is more than 35,000. According to Sunday morning attendance, Calvary Chapel is currently ranked as the third largest congregation among the 10 largest churches in the United States, and it is number one among the 10 largest Protestant churches in California. I have heard critics try to dismiss the impact of Calvary Chapel by calling it production line religion. They have accused us of catering to what the world wants to hear by diluting the message of Christ to appeal to the masses. Some critics apparently have decided what God can and cannot do. They've decided that He cannot do the impossible. Other critics, many of whom belong to churches that have not grown in years, which was exactly my situation for well over a decade, adopt a stance of spiritual elitism. To them, smallness proves spirituality, faithfulness, or an unwillingness to compromise. Perhaps they feel that quantity diminishes the quality of the spirituality. Christ talked about the man who buried his talents and wound up holding nothing. Even what he had was taken away. But he also spoke positively about the servant who magnified his talents a thousandfold. And so to say that Christ purposely limits the size and impact of a ministry is unfounded. The explosive force of ministry also can be taken as a sign that God is genuinely at work. Who can forget the day of Pentecost, when 3,000 turned to Christ on the streets of Jerusalem, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Acts 2:47. Just as the Jews soon discovered that they were not able to keep the good news to themselves, but were to include the despised Gentiles, so there was an interesting shifting of gears at Calvary Chapel. Our fellowship began with 25 members who represented mainline traditional America. Yet God called us to share with youth from the counterculture. This outreach took a miracle of love and acceptance. But as each group accepted the other, both grew in number. There was a vital sense of God stepping into the picture as lives changed before our eyes. The sense of being in the middle of a miracle kept reaching higher like a bonfire. And when some hopeless heroin addict throws away the needle and goes to the beach to bring three people to Christ in an afternoon, it's a strong boost to the faith of everyone involved. Another remarkable pattern kept repeating itself. Every time we moved into a new building, our fellowship was already too big for the facilities. We seemed to grow like Chinese checkers jumping across the board. In 2 years, we moved from our original building, one of the first church buildings in Costa Mesa, to a rented Lutheran church overlooking the Pacific. Soon thereafter, we decided to do something unprecedented at that time and move the church to a school that we had bought. The building was not up to code, so we had to tear it down and build another. Hippies and straights, working and smiling side by side, it was such a sight that cars on the highway slowed down to gawk at us. I always felt that the ideal church was about 275 people, so we built accordingly. But by the time the sanctuary of 330 seats was completed in 1969, we were already forced to go to two services and eventually had to use the outside courtyard for 500 more seats. This was all fine in good weather, but there were some problems when the weather was not favorable. By 1971, the large crowds and the winter rains forced us to move again. We bought a 10-acre tract of land in the Costa Mesa Santa Ana border. Orange County was quickly changing, and the once famous orange groves were making way for the exploding population of Los Angeles. Soon after buying the land, we did the unprecedented and erected a giant circus tent that could seat 1,600 at a stretch. This was soon enlarged to hold 2,000 seats. Meanwhile, we began building an enormous sanctuary adjacent to this site. This was all amazing to me and more than a bit frightening. I would sit at the signal across the street looking at the bare lot that we had obligated ourselves to purchase. I'd start to panic. I knew it would take a tremendous amount of money to develop the property. And was I being foolish to obligate these faithful church members to that kind of a project? Why not just be satisfied where we were? The bills were all paid, we had money in the bank, and this new project was going to take a great outlay of cash. But as I sat there, the Lord would speak to my heart. "Whose church is it?" He would ask. I answered out loud, "It's your church, Lord." "Then why are you worried about the money?" He reasoned with me. What an incredible relief. A sense of frantic worry rolled off my shoulders. The finances were not my responsibility. They were his concern. And this was an extremely important lesson for me to learn. It is not my church, it's his church. And God was the one who created the problem. He was the one who brought so many people that we could not house them. God continued to bring people in, and by the time Calvary Chapel Fellowship had celebrated the opening day in 1973 by moving into the vast new sanctuary of 2,200 seats, the building was already too small to contain the number of people. We held three Sunday morning services and had more than 4,000 people at each service. Many had to sit on the carpeted floor. A large portion of the floor space was left without pews in order to provide for this option. I've always felt it important to maintain a sense of intimate fellowship. And for this reason, the building design with pillars and beams that break up the sanctuary into segments of 200 to 500 seats so that each person has a feeling of being in a congregation rather than in a large, crowded auditorium. Even the seating available on the carpeted floor near the front gives a sense of relaxation and not unlike sitting in a meadow. The front platform is simple with a little ornamentation. The seats form a semicircle, communicating that no one is more important than anyone else. It gives an air of fresh openness. Though vast, it avoids pretension. I keep abreast of all of the details of the daily work at Calvary Chapel. I have also instructed my pastoral staff to tell me of any members who wish to see me personally. I make myself readily available and can be called through my secretary. I also make myself accessible to anyone who wants to see me after any of the Sunday morning services, for I stand out in front shaking hands, greeting people, discussing anything that they might have on their hearts. Calvary Chapel also ministers over the airwaves. I believe this accounts for many of those who travel long distances to fellowship here. A Nielsen survey indicated that our Sunday morning Calvary Chapel service is the most listened to program in the area during the entire week. As of 1987, Calvary's outreach had included numerous radio programs, television broadcasts, as well as the production and distribution of tapes and records. The missions outreach is considerable. Calvary Chapel not only supports Wycliffe Bible Translators, Campus Crusade, Missionary Aviation Fellowship, and other groups, but we donate to third world needs at what I felt was the leading from the Lord. We built a radio station in San Salvador and gave it to the local pastors there. We have given money to Open Doors to purchase a ship that, in tandem with a barge, delivered 1 million Bibles to the mainland China. Our financial commitment to missions exceeds our local expense budget by over 50%. Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa averages 200 conversions a week. For years, new believers were put into a highly respected Navigators 14-week home Bible study program. But since then, Calvary Chapel has developed its own course, and as a part of the course, the new believers can attend numerous evening Bible studies and classes that are taught during the week. Along with the Sunday morning and evening service, I also teach an in-depth midweek evening Bible study. On other nights of the week, thousands attend the wide variety of Bible studies and fellowship groups. Calvary Chapel never asks for money. We avoid pressuring our members for faith pledges, and no appeal for funds is ever made over the radio or television outreaches. Our feeling is that begging for money brings discredit to God. Financial integrity is central to this ministry, so much so that all of the staff salaries are considered low by usual standards. I limit myself and my family to a simple lifestyle while my ministry has enabled me to oversee millions of dollars. I want to be responsible to God for this money because it is His money, not mine. I'm merely a steward. And this is important to me because I know that the non-believers are watching and we are responsible for the way we witness to them. I've always had a problem with flashy Christian media celebrities who somehow wind up in palatial manor houses and maintain an affluent lifestyle from God's money. Funds sent in by innocent, trusting, and vulnerable followers in response to high-pressure sales tactics. A personality cult is dangerous, but fiscal extravagance and dishonesty is even more dangerous. The tragedy is that all the public sees, and in the end believes, is this image of Christians. A friend of mine calls this Operation Caricature. These inflated public images of Christianity create a cynical distrust in non-believers and the assumption of insincerity, naivety, or gullibility is all applied to all of us en masse, and our faith is discredited. I believe God has blessed us at Calvary Chapel with an exceptionally loving and open fellowship. Christ told us that the world would know that we are His disciples by our love for one another. And this is our predominant emphasis, and I pray that we can consistently show the world this standard. Certainly our Lord told us that our identification marks as Christians should not only involve love, but also purity and integrity of character of the highest order. Unfortunately, the image the world most often sees of believers is that is presented by those self-elected representatives who parade themselves before the public at large as holy and spiritual, while the scandals of their private lives belie this image. Their lives are as risque as TV soap operas, which bring mocking sneers of discredit from secular observers. We have to show the world something better than that. Yet sadly, that numberless host of unseen Christians across the centuries who have subsisted and denied themselves on and off the mission field, living in scrupulous integrity, men like George Mueller, Hudson Taylor, C.T. Studd, doesn't even gain the slightest flicker from the media spotlight. These great lives pass by in quiet anonymity. God must help us correct these imbalances of our day and equip us to be ambassadors of Christ, which we are called to be. Let me say that in the Calvary Chapel phenomena, I did not just walk into a church the size of an aircraft carrier and become an admiral. The church was not handed over to me like an industrial magnet bequeathing an unworthy son, some multinational enterprise. Instead, I will share with you that I had to work from scratch and obey every new call that came from God, even when those calls seemed irrational. Behind them were blood, sweat, and tears, as well as a number of unforgettable lessons. One of the secrets of my preparation for this work, I am convinced, was my desert years. Those years of struggle, it was in this crucible that God prepared my character for the coming work. God so often makes a mockery of outward circumstances. He repudiates the impossible if we will only but believe. And believe me, my situation looked impossible, absolutely impossible at times.